People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, just at the Baxter Theatre, play that's just finished called Unruly is being taken over by a new play called Feedback, both the work of Andrew Buckland, who is my guest this week, one of South Africa's most celebrated theatre makers, with a career spanning several decades across stage, film and television. He's received 20 national and international awards, including 3 Fringe First Awards at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe and Best Actor accolades at the Fleur de Cup, Word Fierce and Naledi Awards. He's part of the cast of Life and Times of Michael Kay, played Hamlet for the SABC, performed in Kagiso Lediga's film Catching Feelings, and has collaborated on numerous productions, including Firefly, and a host of other things. But Andrew is here specifically to talk about Feedback, which is described here, let me tell you, as an extraordinary murder mystery that, under the unique and unconventional vision of Andrew, transforms into a farcical, uproarious and eccentric work of physical theatre. So, Andrew Buckland, welcome to People of Notes. Good
Thank
to have you.
You
here.
Thank you, Rod. It's an honor.
The word physical theatre is what I constantly think of you as. And if you can talk about Unruly for a while,
right,
because that was the one about baboons and humans, wasn't it?
Yes.
Which was a very physical thing as well, wasn't it?
Yes. I was very fortunate to be included in the Unruly project. Amphitheatre, run by Neil Koppen and Dylan McGarry and Pumin Tombeni, were approached by a group of researchers who'd been working with baboon, that were named baboon conflict zones. It's really kind of interaction between mostly human conflict. But anyway, and they had done an extraordinary amount of research through personal interviews and through questionnaires to try and get a sense of what were people's experiences in Simonstown, Komiki, and those areas that were dealing with the issues. And so when Amphitheatre were approached by them, that's very much within their style, to go to work in an area where there's some kind of social issue, to spend a lot of time doing, I suppose, what you'd call scientific or academic research to gain data. But then their skill is to then turn that through characterization and through theatrical means into a theatrical performance, which then provides the hub around which discussions can happen.
Oh, I see. So, and it's called Amphitheatre.
Amphitheatre, yeah. And I'd been wanting to work with them for ages because, in a way, that's how I conceive of theatre, that it is a means of us humans to practice empathy, you know, to really get a sense of what is it like to be in someone else's shoes, that you really do get a sense of how the world seems from someone who you would not, you know, have anything in common with, but to have a sense of why do they have these opinions. They came to me and said, we're doing this thing on baboons. And before they finished the word baboon, I said, yes, please.
Really?
So what emerged was a one-person long-form storytelling, really, drawing on all that research and creating a kind of cast of different characters whom people in those areas would recognize, you know, what they would call the baboon huggers or the haters or the activists or the baboons themselves. Although the baboon was only really characterized physically, his presence there. But essentially, the play is designed to stimulate debate and to provide an environment where people feel safe to express their opinions, you know, with the idea that you're in a room with other people who very strongly disagree with you, but you have an opportunity to give your point of view.
So was this a one-man show? You played a number of roles in the show.
It's two-person. The other person in the show is Chantal Willie-Peterson, who plays the double bass. But she's there, and her presence kind of evokes the presence of my character's wife in the play, whom he's recently lost. So
it's
a combination.
Does she play the double bass?
Yes, yes, beautifully. Oh, beautifully trained jazz and classical musician.
Mm-hmm. That she wrote?
No, I'll have to look in the program for Brahms' surname. Wrote the music and she's executed. But she does vocal improvisation as well. So it's a real combination of carefully crafted music and, in the moment, interplay with me as the actor, you know, as the storyteller.
It's a nice idea, that, isn't it?
It was amazing to play.
Was that your idea entirely, getting a double bass player?
No, that was Neil's, and Neil and Dylan. Neil directed the show, and eventually, from all the research, scripted the play. So his dramaturgy, the craft of creating the kind of journey that the audience goes on, was really masterful. Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
A colleague of mine went to see it, and she told me about, she seemed to be quite impressed by a mask that you used on and off, depicting, I think, a baboon or something like that.
Yeah, it was a baboon that was made by Dylan McGarry, who's a very skilled visual artist as well. We didn't want to anthropomorphize or whatever it is, the baboons, but we wanted his presence on stage. So I worked quite a long time during the early processes. We had a chance to sit with baboons in the wild, well, in the Tokai forest.
It's not so wild anymore, is it?
Not anymore. But to spend some time observing them and just watching them and listening to them, you know. So out of that came a series of short little sequences that related to the story, but really brought in a kind of another much more visceral interaction with the baboon without hearing him talk about what he wants or whatever.
Because you have a thing about baboons because of this story about them being culled. I read someone, I'm sure I saw a picture of you in the newspaper where you were speaking out about this whole problem.
Oh, that's quite possible. Yes, I was approached by one of the activists that we had worked with in Simonstown to say, with this whole new proposal to remove 120 baboons, was I prepared to make a statement about it? And I did just do a quick sort of WhatsApp video about it to appeal that the people who are making that decision hold before they do that, because it feels like it's a decision that's being made without the necessary kind of level of collaboration and integration and listening to all the parties who are involved in it. So I made that statement. I mean, my attachment to baboons, or my thing with baboons, kind of goes further back. I had a very close friend whom I met at university. Her name was Kate Jago. She was a visual artist. And as a teenager, she had broken her neck, a C6. So she's quadriplegic. She had a little electric wheelchair. And we became very good friends. She was a contemporary of my wife's sister in East London at school. And over the years, we both moved to Joburg. She was an activist. She worked very hard in getting buildings to make places disabled or other abled, you know, accessible. But in the last few years of her life, she married a river ecologist in Cape Town, and they built a house in Pringle Bay. And they built that little house in whatever it turned out to be exactly on the route that baboons took when they were coming down to the lowlands.
Right.
But she had an encounter with a baboon. This big male came into the house, and because she's in a wheelchair and she is a very calm person who loves nature and already loved baboons, she just sat quietly, you know. So the baboon didn't fret, because he took a bit of fruit and then he went. And then Kate and her husband just, you know, they knew what the baboon's rules are. You keep the doors closed. You don't have food available. You don't have anything that would invite them to be there. But every day she would drive her motorized wheelchair out onto the deck at the same time when the baboons used to come past. So over a period of about 6, 8, maybe 10 months by the time I went to visit her, this troop started to hang out at her house.
A whole troop, not just
the
that
whole
one
troop. Male. The alpha would be circling around and just skipping it up. But mothers with babies, sub-adults, juveniles, all over the place, climbing all over the umbrellas on the roofs. Then they got to know her very well. And by the time I went to visit her when she was being visited by the baboons, they were sitting on her lap and grooming her, wild baboons. And interfering with her chair, curious as hell, you know. And she told me they're very clear rules as well. If they want something, a towel that you've got, they've got it, because possession is all.
And there was no aggression or anything like that?
Absolutely none.
Gosh, that's amazing.
It was an amazing example of the fact that it is possible to coexist if you acknowledge that there are certain ways of things that you, if you choose to live in an area that has baboons as their natural habitat. So like if you choose to live in a windy area, you build a house that deals with that. So if you're going to live with baboons, your life is going to be affected by it. And they found a way to live, you know, coexist with baboons that really was the most beautiful, peaceful, fantastic experience. So from that time, I had a passion for baboons. So as I say, when they offered me the chance to work on it, I just jumped.
Absolutely, I can imagine. Okay, we'll come back to that, but now I want to know your first piece of music, Andrew.
Well, I, as a teenager, the first album I ever bought was an album by Cream, Eric Clapton's, one of his first bands. I think because I'm the youngest of seven, and the middle brother, and they always had more than me because they were older, you know. He happened to have his own record player and a set of big white headphones and a set of blues records, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, Fleetwood Mac. So it was my secret naughty pleasure to, when he was out, to sneak into his room and listen to blues. And I fell in love with blues right from then. And Fleetwood Mac, the early Fleetwood Mac, before they became a pop band, was a kind of passion for a while.
Is that what we're going to hear now?
Yes.
Early Fleetwood Mac.
Yes, early Fleetwood Mac, led by a guy called Peter Green, who was the guitarist, and a song called Oh Well.
About the shape I'm in, I can't sing, I ain't pretty, and my legs are thin. But don't ask me what I think of you, I might not give the answers that you want me to. Now when I talked to God, I knew he'd understand. He said, stick by me and I'll be your guiding hand. But don't ask me what I think of you, I might not give the answer that you want me to.
That was the group Fleetwood Mac, a piece called Oh Well, the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week, the actor Andrew Buckland. And you say that was the old original Fleetwood Mac.
Yes, when they were a blues band led by Mick Fleetwood and Peter Green was the guitarist.
Okay. Did you go off them a bit when they changed into a pop group?
No, I appreciated them in a different way. I used to love, with Stevie Nicks, I used to love those albums.
I'm talking to Andrew Buckland for various reasons. He's just finished a play at the Baxter called Unruly, as you heard, about baboons and humans. And he's just written a play called Feedback, which has just opened at the Baxter. We'll come to that in a moment, Andrew. But you mentioned amphitheater. And remember the days of agitprop?
Yes.
Which was the whole political thing. Mm. Is this amphitheater, is that doing a similar sort of thing, but in a more empathetic way? Or was that a useless combination?
No. The way Dylan McGarry, who's one of the founders, describes it, is it's a kind of, it's like political acupuncture.
That's
you know, that you don't bang a hammer on the thing to try and get it to listen to you. You go in quietly and calmly, and two human beings meet each other. Eventually, the idea is that I can listen to you. What we experienced in the research is that there's a very clear perception that it's utterly polarized, you know, that there are wild opinions on both sides. And most of that is quite limited because on the WhatsApp groups where most of that argy-bargy happens, the loudest voices dominate. But the majority of people that they interviewed and that answered questionnaires were very happy to live with baboons, didn't obviously want them raiding and messing their houses, but they wanted to find a way to coexist. So the kind of agitprop nature of it, the attempt to try and get people to address the issue and to draw people's attention to the problems that are there is done in a through empathy, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
So that the structure of the work, it's storytelling, which happens in a circle. And so you are actively sitting in a room across from other people. You're able to witness theirs. And then afterwards, there's a talkback session where you're able to say, yes, I saw this in the play, but I have an experience like that, or I recognize someone like that, or I see myself in that person. Or I can say, this is misrepresenting because this is my experience of baboons. You know,
okay.
So that debate or that discussion, conversation can happen in the space.
Did you have a talk back afterwards? Did you invite the audience to chat afterwards?
Yes. So the main period of performances was actually not in theaters. We performed last year in 2024 in Simonstown, Komaki, in Ocean View, in
This play itself,
yeah. But then it's in a very different context. You don't have all the technical support of lights and smoke and mirrors or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just a group of people in a circle. And most of those people are invited or they're open to say, if you're interested in baboon issues, here's a chance. And the major focus of those interactions, the play is merely a stimulus, you know, so that it presents the people who are dealing with baboons in different ways, and we learn about their own personal lives. And grief is a central kind of theme of it, because it connects the idea of grief from loss of a partner, but also grief from loss of land, loss of home, and it invites that kind of emotional state. So at the end of it, it's very difficult to stand up and go swearing at the baboon huggers or haters. Everyone's kind of equalized to a situation to say, oh, I'm prepared now to hear your point of view without just losing my temper at you.
Do you think you made a difference?
It's hard to gauge exactly, because part of the problem is that the people who are attracted to those things tend to be the people who are interested in supporting baboons.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You're not going to get the other side, really.
We did get some, and I brought that up in one of the feedback sessions as well. There's a character called Henk, who is a kind of typical guy who will not tolerate baboons because it interferes with his human activities. You know, saying to the group, it's very difficult to get Henk to come to the theater. And the man next to me leant over and said, there's a bit of Henk in all of us.
That's true.
So,
that's an interesting thing to have said.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. It hasn't made a difference in policy immediately. But we did do performances for people who were connected to Cape Nature and with the Rangers. So we hopefully are asking people who are making policy decisions to view it in a different way, apart from just standing in the middle of these, you know, opposing voices and then trying to satisfy everybody.
Yeah.
And certainly the people who came to see the play, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of questions about what do we do now? You know, you don't give us any solutions, but Empathetic is not there to give solutions, you know. But I said, in my opinion, what happened on that day with this group of people sitting in a circle, hearing each other, seeing each other, sharing in this long-form storytelling about issues that are very close to their hearts and being able to hear each other, that's part of the solution, you know? The fact that we can, as human beings, acknowledge each other and listen.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a pity then that it's over, or is it going to travel a bit more?
This is the first theatrical kind of season it's had.
Oh, the others have all been in the smaller towns, as you said.
Yeah, exactly. And then we perform, we have two performances in Joburg at a transformation conference, a conservation conference. And then Empathetic has connection with all sorts of conferences around the world where these kind of issues are brought up. So it might well be playing.
I hadn't heard of Empatheatre before. Mm. So have they been fairly active?
Oh, yeah. They've made several works. I would think about 5 or 6. But they don't really come on the public radar because they performed for a community about that community. Oh, there was one about waste pickers in KwaZulu-Natal, another one about migrant women, another about people who live near the sea and how their access to the sea and to their ancestral traditional meaningfulness of the sea is interrupted by different things. So those are there performed for those people to have debates around it.
Okay. Well, now I want to move on to your next, what's playing at the moment, Feedback. But before that, let's break with a piece of music, break away from the baboons before we get to your next piece. What is your next piece?
The next is a piece from an album called Four Way Street by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And it was a kind of formative album that my wife and I listened to often when we went to Joburg. I suppose it kind of reflected my hippie era, if you like.
That group does, doesn't
it? Yeah. But we loved it. I still do as well. But there was a track there called Winchester Cathedral, which was a kind of favorite of Janet and mine.
And crossing swords with the people against the hordes who came to conquer. Seven o'clock in the morning, here he comes. I taste the warning. I'm so amazed I'm here today, seeing things so clear this way. In the car my way to Stonehenge. I'm flying in Winchester Cathedral, sunlight pouring through the break of day. Stumble through the door and into the chamber. There's a lady setting flowers on a table, covered lace. And a cleaner in a distance finds a cobweb on her face. And a feeling deep inside of me tells me this can't be the place. Flying in Winchester Cathedral, all religion has to have its day. Expressions on the face of the Savior made me say, I can't stay. Open up the gates of the church and let me out of here. Too many people have lied in the name of Christ for anyone to heed the call. So many people have died in the name of Christ that I can't believe it all. Now I'm standing on the grave of a soldier that died in 1799. And the day he died, it was a birthday, and I noticed it was mine. And my head didn't know just who I was, and I went spinning back in time. And I am high up on the altar, high, up on the altar, high.
Winchester Cathedral, that even takes me back, Andrew. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I remember that so well. And it was the second choice of my guest, Andrew Buckland, talking to him about a play about baboons unruly, which has just finished. However, feedback has just opened at the Baxter. And it says here, Andrew, an extraordinary murder mystery that, under the unique and unconventional vision of you, transforms into a farcical, uproarious, and eccentric work of physical theatre. It almost seems impossible that a murder mystery could turn into a farcical bit of theatre. Tell me a little bit about feedback.
So, in the late 80s, I made a show called The Ugly Nunu.
Well, that was one of your very famous pieces.
Yes, yeah, one of the first pieces that really introduced that particular form of physical theater. So I didn't have any props, didn't have anything on the stage. And I'd been lucky as a student to be introduced to classical mime techniques. So I was able to use that minimally, but as part of the storytelling technique. To what attracted me about mime technique is that there's nothing on the stage except the actor's body. The whole action of the story takes place in the audience's imagination. You know, I might stick my hands up and move my body, but it's the audience that sees the wall, and each one sees their own wall. I love that about it.
Yes. Eventually, it is an extraordinary thing, mime, I have to say.
I love it, but essentially that's what theater for me, or the value of theater, and it's connected to this idea of empathy as well, is that it's my job as an actor not to, if I'm playing a tragic part, not to suffer all this emotion. My task is to craft a piece of work that stimulates the audience's imagination to have their own journey dealing with those particular issues.
Actually, that's a very interesting aspect, because you assume that the actor is going to be all traumatized by what he's doing.
No, that's where the craft is. You know, my job is not to feel the emotion and have you witness it and say, mm-hmm. "Oh, shame!" It's a
I must feel it.
Exactly,
you must make me feel it.
Yes,
you must traumatize me.
Well, yes, that's what you paid for.
Well, that's true. Yes.
So that was the way in which that the style of that work, and it did seem to have an impact, but then come the 80s and then heading towards the 90s. By the time we came to 92, it was clear what was happening. And the targets of satire were shifting, you know, and it just wasn't the same kind of playing field. So my attention went much more to broader issues. And if we're talking about human rights, what do we have a right? We have a right to water and to food and to shelter. So I started to research, what are the politics of water and food? How does control of either of those, how's that being used by human beings? Because we inevitably will use it to manipulate situations where some people have power and some people don't.
Human nature, isn't it? Very much
exactly.
So. Yeah.
So after doing quite a lot of research on food and food sources and those kind of things, I was looking to create that into a piece of work that used the same attitude as The Ugly Nunu. In other words, that it casts a different light on a familiar thing. So in Ugly Nunu, it was about an insect, you know. But if we put a different light on it and give the possibility, allow the possibility, the surreal possibility for this insect to express itself and tell us what it needs, you invite a whole new way of seeing
indeed,
that relationship.
Gosh. Yeah, yeah.
So the same thing was with food, because there was quite a turning point. I was in a supermarket, and the shelf packers were speaking to each other, and the one asked the other, "How are these cheeses doing?" And he said, "Oh, they're flying off the shelf." And I couldn't help but stop and make a note of that. because then you ask just normal kind of theatrical questions I wouldn't ask an actor, you know, what's mm-hmm. your motivation? If you're flying, why are you flying? What do you want that you're doing that? And it seemed that the answer came back, because the ultimate purpose for food, and that which will fulfill it, is to be eaten. And the way the world is and the way structures of food distribution work now, so much food is wasted, not just by the manufacturers and the retailers or whatever, but by us human mm-hmm. consumers as well. Mm-hmm. There's so much that is just discarded. And if I gave foodstuffs sentience, how would they feel about it? So then started to emerge this whole universe, which I started to craft into a play. And just as a part of my wife is fascinated by true crime and also by murder mysteries, you know. And so they were always part of the milieu at home.
Well, and also audiences are fascinated
audiences
by
love
crime.
It. Yeah. So I thought, what about using the mode of a murder mystery and using a character of a detective in a way to represent us, the audience, through the play? He's asking the questions.
Okay, the detective, well, yes.
So I started to write a play in which the food can speak, has an opinion, and in fact organizes itself into a full foodstuff rebellion, breaks out of the stockpile in the cause of self-distribution.
Yeah. All acted by you physically, mime.
Yes. Initially, it was a one-person show. Yeah.
Okay.
The story centered around an orphan in the middle of a famine. The whole landscape is this desolate famine. But in the mountains, there is a shelter that's run by a gargantuan woman called Mother Mirth, who has taught all these kids how to feed themselves with permaculture and plant cartels and how to manage small-scale farming. But of course, that farm is destroyed by the big corporate multinational called the Dearth Foodstuff Multinational, who are cartoonesque bad guys, you know, villains,
yes,
drawn straight out of, I suppose, a kind of Disney world. Ursula at the bottom of the sea and Little Mermaid, and I can't remember any of the others, but it's very much on that style. So it's grotesque and surreal. And then the murder mystery, mother gets murdered, so then they have to follow the clues. Again, it was an idea, because The Ugly Nunu was very much about what was going on in South Africa at the time, the terrifying situation that was about to explode.
Yeah,
and it struck me at the time that it reflected something in me. You know, if I witnessed my behavior or my neighbor's behavior when confronted with this little insect, which has evolved itself to be very aggressive looking. It's got big horns and crusty things. So people are terrified of it, and it's completely harmless. So instantly, fear turns into violence. And that's what had been happening and still happens in this country and around the world, all over the place. So that was trying to deal with that quite serious issue through this idea of bizarre comedy, satirical comedy. So in Feedback, it was the same thing, to get us to think about the way in which the world deals with food and the way in which access to food is used as a weapon of war, which it absolutely is at the moment, every day, front of our faces.
Every day.
And it's grotesque.
Right,
so, you know, if I look at the action in the play, it's not that far. You know, the villains are not that far from what's going on. So it's inviting people to consider that. How does it impact on the way that I source food? When I go and buy food, where do I get it from? Do I follow the source of where it's come from? Do I take any responsibility for that? Or how do I feed myself? All of those things. The audience is invited to consider, I think, after the play. During the play, hopefully there's enough theatricality and satire and humor and comedy just to keep them laughing that they can't think because they're laughing so much.
Right.
But then afterwards,
then they start
thinking back and think,
wait a minute. This
relates to that, perhaps.
Let's have another piece of music, Andrew.
So in the even earlier part of the 80s, I was lucky enough to meet a Polish musician called Maciek Szabel, who introduced me to jazz, changed everything around the world. But he also introduced me to Northern African and West African jazz. And particularly, one of the earliest peoples he introduced me to was a musician called Salif Keita. And his album called Soro was one that would be playing in our combi constantly when we were out performing.
Yeah.
And that's a track from that, I think, called Soro.
piece called Sorrow, Salif Keita. And that's the name of the album, isn't it, Andrew?
Yes.
It's another choice, the third choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note. I'm talking to Andrew Buckland, and his play Feedback has just opened at the Baxter Theatre and runs through until the 30th of August. So you can catch Feedback, which, as you've just heard, the word feedback is a clue there, what you're talking about, depicting food. And you know, Andrew, always, whenever I think of you, I think of you as an insect or an animal or something, I'm sorry, because you're very physical on stage. You spoke about the mime thing. Mm. It amazes me that you played Hamlet, which requires such discipline. Mm. But clearly you have created a freedom for yourself. I mean, how do you play a piece of cheese, for example?
Okay.
That was what's your secret?
That the first challenge. I did another play called Between the Teeth, which was about language. I was stimulated to do it because I realized at that time, early 90s, I'm unilingual. And that is my disadvantage and my fault, you know. So it meant I was denied access to an extraordinary, you know, field of knowledge and of interaction with people. And plus, I was less able to understand other people. So in a kind of satirical critique of that, I looked at language, the way in which language, again, what's the politics of language? How was it used to manipulate? And one of the mechanisms was to put sound or word with inappropriate gesture. Within that, there was a sort of sequence which put war and money together. So the mime action that the audience saw would be me pulling pistol guns. But the sound they would hear would be dollar, 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 dollar.
Oh, okay.
Machine gun would be yen, 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 yen. So they're hearing monetary currencies, but they're seeing violence.
Violence,
There's a, hopefully there's some kind of connection between the two.
Yeah,
so the whole play was about putting language and action sort of contrapuntally. Or sometimes they'd be together and sometimes they'd play in opposition. So then the idea is, you're asking the audience's imagination to do that. You're giving them contrary messages at the same time to see what that does. And normally it creates a laugh because it's unusual.
Yeah.
So then I thought, okay, if the cheeses are flying and a cheese is called cheddar, then what if we characterize it like a bird, but its call is cheddar, cheddar, cheddar.
And I see.
The other cheese is feta, feta, or halloumi.
Right.
And then the image is of actors flapping their wings and nodding their heads and doing bird behavior. But they've been called cheeses by the other characters. And they call out cheese words. I mean, the sort of confusion of those two things. Immediately, we step into the surreal world where I can imagine a flock of cheeses flying in over the horizon and landing.
It must be quite difficult. Oh, now let me think how I should say this. To direct you or for you to be directed, because what you're doing is unique in many ways for an actor.
You know, I was very fortunate. My wife, Janet, we studied together and she was brilliant at directing this kind of work. Because, number one, she knew the things that I would find easy. You know, she could say, okay, well, that's, you know how to do that. Find me something more interesting. And she also understood the mime work as well. And there was no, we didn't waste any time worrying about egos or whatever. We both wanted to do was make really good product. And then Laura directed Lionel Newton and
I. Is this Laura Foote?
Laura Foote, yes.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Directed Lionel Newton and I in a show called The Well-Being, which very much was a culmination of this style, the combination of mime and physical portrayal, but also the possibility of surreal elements. Because at the heart of mime, because there's nothing on the stage, anything can happen.
Yes, that's the thing. It's quite haunting, actually, in a way, watching mime, in a sense that you never know what's going to happen next, or where you'll be led by the mime artist, which is perhaps the most scary.
And I was also just extremely fortunate. My life has been a series of blows of good fortune, I can't tell you. I mean, apart from we all have tragedy and loss, but there have been such amazing things that have happened to me. The access that I've had to people teaching me the mime skills and other people to work those, to develop, to meet Maciek. He taught me about self-respect as an artist and to take responsibility myself for my own training, you know, because we were on tour and he would be waking up at 7 o'clock playing 2 hours on the hi-hat, 2 hours on the bass. And he said to me, well, when do you practice? no, I'm an actor, you know. In fact, I got a couple of awards, you know. He said, no, how can you hold yourself as an artist and respect unless mm-hmm. you practice? There's a reason it's called a practice. He says you must train. And it was only from that day, because I remembered classes from when I was studying, I could get up every day and start training myself and being ready for whatever came along.
And I bet that helped.
Yeah, that became a vital part of it as well. Yeah. And then when I was lucky enough to be cast as Hamlet, in a way you're using the same principles but with a different style, you know, the attention to detail of physicality and how much that can give information without you even opening your mouth, you know.
Wow, that's true. Even something as wordy as Hamlet's.
Exactly, so yeah.
Let's have Frank Zappa, you see, you've chosen. I'm not sure how often Frank Zappa appears on FMR.
Yes, this is a safe track.
Okay.
there's no text. Later in his life, I think when he was sick, he started working with a German orchestra called the Yellow Shark, and they created an album where he wrote for this ensemble. And this is a track called G-Spot Tornado.
Frank Zappa, G-Spot Tornado, well, off the Yellow Shark album. I think that might have been a first on FMR. Andrew, the choice of Andrew Buckland, who's my guest here. And as I've been telling you, his show Feedback is running at the Baxter until the 30th of August. So it sounds like something you need to go and see, to see how Andrew brings a piece of cheese to life. But Andrew, you seem to be quite busy, I must say. You're doing a fair amount, aren't you? You always seem to be around.
It's crazy. You know, I'm getting a lot more work now as an actor than I ever did as a young actor. I mostly had to make my own work, you know, but now I've had some really amazing opportunities to work with Laura Foote and the Handspring Company on Life and Times of Michael Kay.
Yes,
to work on Unruly. I get this chance to direct feedback with the Fires Burning Company at the Baxter. So I've been very lucky, you know, as a... I suppose there are fewer and fewer actors of my age that are still standing.
I don't know about that. There's some veterans about.
No, that's true. That's true. I just make myself available a lot now, I think, because I'm lucky enough to.
And are you still obviously writing a lot and doing the sort of thing like you've done in feedback?
No. I haven't looked at creating new work for quite a few years just because, well, I don't know why. Things have just changed, I suppose. Our whole lives have swiveled around in a way.
Yes.
And I'm not in a rush, you know. It always felt like when you have the need for those things, it'll present themselves. And I've been lucky enough to get jobs. You know?
Did you always want to be an actor? I know you went to Rhodes and all that and ended up teaching there as well, but did you always want to be an actor?
This is a long story, so
but I'll make You'll have to edit it.
I will. So as a schoolboy, I had no idea of theatre. I had been to one, you know, Godspell or something.
Oh.
Went to university. I grew up in what was then Rhodesia. By the time I left school, everyone was getting called up, so I went to Rhodes to study. My father was an accountant, so I started studying accountancy.
Oh, really? Okay.
Very shortly, I knew it was wrong. I changed to physical education, so I was at least doing sporty stuff. In my second year, to get out of a date with a girl that was just too much for me, I said, oh, I have to go to that, and it was an audition sign. I went to the drama department, I auditioned, and changed my degree the next day to study drama.
That's quite a story.
So that, well, I was 21 then, yeah, well, I was 20, and then everything changed, and I started from then to study and then to play.
And as they say, you've never looked back.
Occasionally look back, but not for too long.
Andrew, it's been great talking to you. It's been fascinating talking to you. And a reminder that your play Feedback is on at the moment at the Baxter. It runs till the 30th of August. So thanks for coming in. And what's going to play you out?
Firstly, thank you for having me and listening to me for all this time.
And
for
playing this
favorite music of mine.
That's what we're about here.
The Hadouk Trio is a French jazz trio that I came across just through exploring. And it's basically just my favorite music at the moment, and I use it to warm up to before the performances and to go to sleep to. So I wouldn't dare pronounce the title, but I think, no, it sounds like I'm going to dare.
Yes, do dare, do dare.
Souci, I think it's called.
Okay, so that's what we'll. Andrew, thanks very much, and best of luck.
Thank you, Rodney.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. FMR.